Okay, our next speaker is Chris Baliga. He did his internal medicine residency at the University Hospitals of Cleveland, Case Western Reserve University. He did an infectious disease fellowship at the University of Washington. He was a research fellow at Baylor College of Medicine, senior fellow at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington. He was then an assistant professor at Cornell University before entering practice here in Ogden. He works at McCady Hospital and has been a real asset in infectious disease specialty for our local community. He's going to be speaking today on antibiotic updates for 2013. Let's welcome Dr. Baliga.
All right, thanks for having me. So the requested topic was infections and antibiotics that are new and different. And unfortunately, there aren't that many, fortunately or unfortunately for you. So we'll start off with my disclosures. Really, I don't have any. The only disclosure I'll say is that I am the director of antimicrobial stewardship at McKD, and I serve on various corporate Intermountain boards for this. So I actually have a vested interest that you don't prescribe the antibiotics we're going to talk about today, because they're all expensive. And the last thing I'll say, this is your standard antibiotic little statement that I've made all the efforts I can to ensure the doses are correct, but please verify them yourselves. So at the end of this presentation, I hope that you'll be able to understand the pharmacology of newer antimicrobial agents, the utility, potential indications for newer agents, as well as limitations, I might add, and kind of as a reference to start off here, understand the basic meanings of some of the alphabet soup we throw out in infectious disease these days, including MRSA, VRE, ESBLs, KPCs, and other MDROs, or multi-drug resistant organisms. So I just thought I'd throw out this slide. I thought this was a nice way to start about this. Between 83 and 87, there were 16 new antibiotics approved. Between 2007 and 2012, there were only two. And I'll say that at this point, Johnson & Johnson has one antibiotic pending approval, or I should say pending resubmission for approval. GSK, AstraZeneca, Merck are still involved in research into antibiotics. But a good chunk of the companies have gotten out of this, including Pfizer, Roche, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly. And they're officially saying that it's not worth it financially to do it, so they are not going to do it. So a lot of the burden is going to start shifting, I think, onto academia. NIH, the NIAID, is having a push to try to promote research into antibiotics, especially for gram-negative organisms. So the newer antibiotics we're going to try to talk about today, anti-MRSA antibiotics, there are actually quite a few. I would say that at this point we probably don't need that much more research into MRSA coverage. Things that you may or may not have heard of include ceftaroline, ceftobiprole, telavancin, tigecycline, daptomycin, linezolid, and I put in parentheses here quinupristin, dalfopristin, or cinersid. And fosfomycin, those aren't actually new. They're older drugs that are making a resurgence because of drug resistance. Anti-VRE, another bug for which there's a problem. Similar drugs as for the MRSA, tigecycline, daptomycin, linezolid, telavancin, cinersid, fosfomycin. C. diff drugs, fidaxomicin is one of the new ones that have come out recently. And gram-negative drugs, you'll notice this is much shorter, and really there's only one newer drug out there, and it's the tigecycline. Again, fosfomycin and polymyxin E, or also known as colistin, also known as colistemethate, those are really our remaining drugs, and that's it. So we'll get a bit into the ID alphabet soup. So hopefully you'll, at the end of this, know if you don't already, MRSA, VISA, VRSA, VRE, ESBLs, AMPC-producing organisms, and KPCs, or as they're now called, CREs. So staph resistance, I throw this up there. Penicillin resistance is caused by an enzyme. When penicillin first came out, it was a great staph drug. course, we don't use it anymore. Penicillinase rapidly emerged in the population of Staph aureus, and for the most part now, we just tell you to assume that penicillin doesn't work. Then you have the anti-staphylococcal penicillins, nafcillin, dicloxacillin, oxacillin. Their resistance gives you MRSA, and I think this is something that gets a lot of press, and we all know about it. Primarily, it's the MECA gene. It encodes a mutation in the penicillin-binding protein such that you now get penicillin-binding protein 2A. MIC creep is a term that you probably have heard about or you will be hearing about. If the MIC to vancomycin is greater than 2, then you cannot achieve a therapeutic level of vancomycin with a trough of 15 to 20, which is the generally accepted safety range that we use now. And MIC creep really refers to the fact that if you go back over retrospective studies and look at the MIC to vancomycin 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it tended to be 0.5 to 1. Nowadays, it tends to average around 1 to 1.5 here in Ogden in Houston, where I used to practice, it was closer to 2. And in various parts of the country, this will be 2 or greater. If the MIC is equal to 2 or greater, then you need help. So Visa, I will state that I have no relationship to the credit card company. The credit card company of Visa actually sued the Infectious Disease Society of America to change the name. And for a while, this was called GISA, or glycopeptide intermediate Staph aureus, but they lost that suit, and we've reverted back to the standard Visa. I do find it kind of cute that they were worried we would tarnish their reputation with this. So VISA stands for vancomycin intermediate Staph aureus, MIC of 4 to 8. So this is a range where the lab will not call it resistant, but it's not really susceptible either. And this is thought to be due to the thickened cell wall of Staph aureus, and that's kind of what the pictures are showing. You end up with a Staph aureus that doesn't look all that healthy. And it's because the cell wall is getting thickened, and it's not always in a productive way, but that thickened cell wall will then interfere with our ability to treat it. And really, there's no change in the binding site for vancomycin. What it really is indicating is as the cell wall gets thicker, that's now a competitive inhibition for the binding sites for vancomycin, and it's just harder for it to work. VRSA, vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus, is thankfully rare, has not been described in the state of Utah. It has an MIC greater than 16. Why? This is due to acquisition of the VAN-A gene from vancomycin-resistant enterococci into the Staph aureus that then confers it the same resistance that you see in VRE. And if you remember this from your board exams, instead of the Diala-Diala side chain, you now have a Diala-Dlac, and that interferes with the binding. So VRE, as we kind of just alluded to, Enterococcus faecalis is typically ampicillin susceptible and vancomycin susceptible. Enterococcus faecium is typically ampicillin resistant but vancomycin susceptible. Those are inherent properties of the bacteria. That's not an indicator of resistance. VRE is a term that we use to describe Enterococcus that is now resistant to vancomycin, and as we just said, both faecalis and faecium really should be susceptible to it in their native state. Can be caused by the VAN-A gene. Typically, there's also a VAN-B, there's a VAN-C gene. In antimicrobial resistance, there's a lot of emerging studies, and a lot more of this is more complicated than I'm going to lead you to believe in these slides. Leave it to say that when you have VRE, vancomycin will not work, and often but not always, ampicillin will not work if it's faecalis as well. Gram negatives. So an ESBL, this is another term that many of you have heard of or you will be hearing of. It's an extended spectrum beta-lactamase producing gram negative. Classically, it was described in E. coli and Klebsiella, but can be found pretty much in any of the Enterobacteriaceae. Despite an in vitro susceptibility profile that will show some susceptibility, what this really means when we find it is most beta-lactams and cephalosporins do not work reliably. And a good lab, most labs will typically suppress the results as a guide to treatment. Treatment options for these are complicated. Our go-to drugs really are carbapenems. If it's typically we'll say use an ertapenem for this. aminoglycosides usually do work because we tend not to use aminoglycosides, and that is a saving grace really for a lot of our gram-negative resistance. If you're really lucky, a quinolone will work, but oftentimes through independent mechanisms you will have quinolone resistance in addition to the ESBL. AMP-C producers, I'll just throw this out there, this is kind of a high-level talk. It's a derepressed AMP-C mutant in a population of bacteria. We typically say these are inducible resistance. It's a plasmid-mediated, easily transferred resistance mechanism. And if anyone never did any lab work, AMP-C is one of the common genes we introduce into bacteria during our studies to try to select out the bacteria that we've now introduced genes of interest into. Typically what you'll see is an initial susceptibility pattern on a culture that shows, yes, it works, they get better or they don't get better, they're failing, you culture them again and now it's resistant. What you've really done is selected out a population that's resistant to this. There's a couple mnemonics that go by this. In Houston, we used to teach the residents and the students space organisms. In Seattle, the term of preference was spice. They're equally fine. Just to throw this up here so you can hear it, Serratia, Providentia, Pseudomonas, Proteus, Acinetobacter, Citrobacter, and Enterobacter, all are organisms that potentially carry an AMP-C plasmid. I don't jump to assuming that you have to treat these in a different way, but if someone is failing standard treatment, it's worth thinking about. Treatment for these, classically we say do a carbapenem. Again, they're more stable in this environment and they're able to continue treating it. There's some people that argue cefepime is an okay choice. It may be, it may not be. It tends to be the most stable of the cephalosporins against the AMP-C enzymes. But I typically say if you're doing this, you're already worried, I would just go to a carbapenem. So carbapenemases, I still call these KPCs. This was the original term used to describe them. I've noticed in the press, and actually now the CDC has changed its website to reflect the term CRE, which actually makes more sense from a description standpoint. I'm just stubborn. So KPC stands for Klebsiella pneumoniae carbapenemases. It was originally described in Klebsiella. That's where the name came from. But it is found in most enterics, most of your Enterobacteriaceae, hence the new name, which is carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. I'm waiting to get sued by CRE Richard Ellis. Also in Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter, so it's not just in your enterics. This is a bad thing. This tends to confer resistance to most beta-lactam, cephalosporins, carbapenems, and S-trianam. So we'll start off with the first of our new drugs here now that we've given you kind of an overview of what these resistance terms are, and this may help you understand what these drugs were designed to treat. So ceftaroline or Teflaro, approved in 2010. It's officially approved for a community-acquired pneumonia due to MSSA, methicillin-susceptible staph aureus, but not MRSA. That's purely because that's how it was studied. It works for pneumococcus, including Enterobacterium. It works for Haemophilus, Klebsiella, E. coli in a non-ICU patient. Skin and soft tissue infections are the other thing that it's licensed for, and this is for both MSSA and MRSA. Treats all of the other standard skin bugs, group A strep, group B strep. Also gets some gram-negatives, E. coli, and Klebsiella. This is a twice-a-day drug. If there's normal renal function, it does need dose adjustment if you have renal failure. Contraindications are fairly standard, anaphylaxis to it or other cephalosporins. It's actually fairly well tolerated. It has kind of the standard run of reactions, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, rash, transaminitis, and phlebitis. I think the transaminitis is the one thing to note when you're using this drug. I do monitor LFTs. One of the interesting side effects is the direct Coombs test seroconversion in about 11% of patients who are on this drug. They say that it has no clinically significant evidence of a hemolytic anemia. It just converts the test, but you know, you got to wonder. So it's bactericidal. It works like all the other cephalosporins too. It binds to your penicillin-binding proteins, including PBP2A of Staph aureus and MRSA. It also gets pneumococcus. Like other cephalosporins, it does not have great activity against ESBLs. I would not use it for that. It's not active against carbapenemase-producing organisms. It is not active against AMP-C cephalosporinase-producing organisms. Unlike other cephalosporins, it does have some activity against ampicillin-susceptible Enterococcus, which is Enterococcus faecalis, but is not good against Enterococcus faecium. So it does buy you, really for the first time, a cephalosporin that may have activity against Enterococcus. It's relatively safe. It's a pregnancy class B. As with all these newer drugs, they're really not tested in children. It's not tested in breast milk, so we don't really know how safe they are. So bottom line on ceftaroline, I think of this as ceftriaxone with MRSA coverage. It's probably the easiest way to do this, and you can throw in a little bit of Enterococcus. It's really licensed only for skin and soft tissue infections and in a community-acquired pneumonia. Just recall that the community-acquired pneumonia indication does not include MRSA. Theoretically, we can use this for MRSA in other settings, including pneumonia and bacteremia. There are studies ongoing in this, and I'm actually very eager to see how this turns out. It is costly. It is non-formulary at Intermountain, and we would discourage its use. I would add that you really need such broad spectrum of coverage. What we found is that the majority of people using this are using it. It's actually a common emergency room drug down at Intermountain Medical Center in Murray. They're using it for cellulitis, and I would argue, do you really need the strong coverage for cellulitis, knowing most of that is strep? And it's even when you renal dose it, it's still a BID drug, so it's not super convenient from an outpatient standpoint or from an emergency room standpoint. So ceftobiprole, or Zevtera, was an antibiotic that really got a lot of us excited in the ID community. It is another cephalosporin. It is actually approved in Canada and the European Union for skin and soft tissue infections. However, in 2009, the FDA denied its request for approval in the United States. And this wasn't a safety issue as much as it was what they felt were fundamental flaws in the study design that made the data that said it actually worked better or as good as other drugs in question. And so it was actually then voluntarily withdrawn from the EU and Canadian market as it really, its use plummeted. It's our most broad spectrum cephalosporin. Gets you MRSA, MSSA, Streptococcus, many gram negatives, including Pseudomonas, Enterococcus faecalis, AMSI-producing organisms, still not good against ESBLs or carbapenemase-producing organisms. So bottom line on this, it's not yet available in the United States. It does seem likely this will eventually be approved unless something new appears in the studies that are out there. I doubt that there will be that the original studies really were dramatically off. It is also BID for non-serious infections, but it's given TID for serious ones. So in that sense, it's kind of like cefepime. It is a TID drug. We do a BID for non-serious infections. If you're really worried, it's going to be fairly frequent. It's tolerated similar to all the cephalosporins, and it is likely to be licensed first for skin and soft tissue infections. But again, do you really need something this broad for a cellulitis? Probably not. Telavancin. I actually honestly don't even know how to say its trade name. I'm going to just ignore it. Approved in 2009, it is an interesting drug. It's a lipoglycopeptide, whereas vancomycin is a glycopeptide. They'll describe it as kind of a hybrid between daptomycin and vancomycin in terms of its structure and mechanism of action. It is a large molecule. It's licensed for skin and soft tissue infections with Staph aureus, both MRSA as well as MSSA. Group A strep, Group B strep, glomerulonephritis strep, as well as vancomycin susceptible strains of Enterococcus faecalis. So this gets you beyond ampicillin into the vancomycin susceptible strains, which makes sense because it's a derivative of vancomycin. It is a once a day drug. It also needs dose adjustment in renal failure. It is pregnancy class C and carries a black box warning about ensuring your patients are not pregnant before you give it. So it does have some precautions. Studies have noticed a decreased efficacy in patients with renal dysfunction, which is interesting. When it was originally marketed, one of the selling points was it becomes a twice-a-day drug in renal dysfunction, and it's cheaper, so the cost differential becomes less severe. However, we have noticed in studies a trend. It's not clear exactly what this is about, that renal dysfunction leads to worse outcomes, and it has now then been put onto the package insert. It also causes QTC prolongation, as does so many things. These days, I always worry with antibiotics now, there's not really a lot we can give anymore without causing a QTC prolongation. It does cause nephrotoxicity. It can lead to Redman syndrome, and of course, with any antibiotic, you can get C. diff. One thing to recall about this, it interferes with your coagulation studies. It's not actually causing the patient to become coagulopathic, it's just screwing up the test. So an INR, a PT, an activated PTT, activated client time and factor 10A-based tests are not useful. Safety is not established in children. Unclear how much is excreted in breast milk. It is a concentration-dependent bactericidal agent and interferes with the cross-leaking of the cell wall and binds spectral membranes and disrupts it. It has in vitro activity against VRE, Ephesium, Visa, but not Versa, Van B VRE, Van A, and Clostridium. So it's actually fairly broad. Bottom line, it's a once-daily vancomycin. It has some extra spectrum of activity against Visa, Van B VRE, lots of limitations, including side effects, and it's not currently available in the United States. Tigecycline, this was approved in 2005, has a lot of indications, complicated skin and soft tissue infections against both MSSA and MRSA, intra-abdominal infections caused by a variety of organisms, and it is licensed for, for an intra-abdominal infection source. Community-acquired pneumonia, it is a twice-a-day drug, does cause a black, carries a black box warning, which is interesting, increased all-cause mortality in patients on tigecycline, versus comparator arms and pool data from 13 clinical trials, and really increased mortality in ventilator-associated pneumonias, and so we do not recommend its use at that time. It can also cause increased bilirubinemia, transaminases, hepatic toxicity. It's bacteriostatic, binds to the 30S ribosomal subunit, and has in vitro activity against a lot of other organisms. Tigecycline is one of our drugs we can use for gram-negative resistance for everything but Pseudomonas, which is its big hole. So bottom line, very broad, BID dosing, worsening trend, increased mortality, and it is one of our salvage drugs for gram-negatives. I have noticed increased trend of resistance as people use it more. One of our big ID gurus in Houston used to promote this for abdominal infections as someone that has a pen allergy, and I used to argue, well, you're going to lose it when you need it, and that's kind of true. Fosfomycin, this is a drug as an outpatient you may actually use. Approved back in 1997, it's been described since the 60s. In the United States, we only have it available as an oral form. In Europe, it is IV. It's indicated in the United States for an uncomplicated UTI with E. coli, Enterococcus faecalis, in adult women. It's not for use in pyelonephritis, not for perinephric abscess. It's not well described in renal failure. The dose is 3 grams of the packet once. Is actually very well tolerated. And what I really would point out with this drug is what I tend to use it for are your ESBL E. coli UTIs. These people that come in, they otherwise need an IV ertapenem agent, but you can sometimes get away, oftentimes actually, with fosfomycin. It works really, really well. It's an old drug. We're using it for these new indications. Zyvox, I'm just going to throw out there because I see this used quite a bit. It's licensed for nosocomial pneumonia with MSSA, MRSA, MRSA pneumococcus, skin and soft tissue infections with MSSA or MRSA, MRSA. Vancomycin-resistant Ephesium infections, community-acquired pneumonia. Really should cover most of your enterococcal strains, and really it covers most of your gram-positives. What I will say, the reason I want to throw this up here, is that side effects of Nasalid are legion. This is the primary reason we don't use it more than we do, besides cost. It can cause a serotonin syndrome, especially when you're on a concomitant SSRI or MAOI, and pretty much everybody nowadays is on an SSRI. It does cause myelosuppression. If you believe the trials, 10 to 40% of patients have to discontinue its use because of significant thrombocytopenia by day 14. 40% I think is high, 10% is probably realistic, and this is a big deal, you've got to stop. Good news is that your platelets usually come back. If you're on it for longer than that, so the reason we don't use this for endocarditis or for osteomyelitis includes neuropathy. Oftentimes, it's peripheral and optic, typically in patients who've been on this for more than 28 days. It may not be reversible, so you may be left with a permanent nerve issue. And it has been associated with increased mortality in catheter-associated bloodstream infections when compared to vancomycin or other drugs. And this is one of the reasons why we say linazole is probably inferior to other agents for a bacteremia, which is another reason people like to use it. Hypoglycemia, lactic acidosis have all been described. It's a twice-a-day pill. There is no advantage of taking this IV if you can get away with it as a pill. That's assuming that you have good absorption from your stomach. Treats most gram-positive organisms and is very expensive. Side effects really are what limits its use. Daptomycin, we see a lot use of, licensed in 2003. Skin and soft tissue infections with MSSA, MRSA. It gets you most of your gram-positives. Bloodstream infections, right-sided endocarditis, MSSA, MRSSA, should cover most of your enterococci. cyclic lipopeptide. We call this the amphotericin of the antimicrobial, of the antibacterial world. It will poke a pore into your staph aureus. Some precautions with this: it is an activated bisurfactant, and so therefore you should not use it for pneumonia. Its big side effect is rhabdomyolysis, and therefore you do need to check weekly CPKs while you're on it. We don't recommend giving it at the same time as a statin. It can cause an eosinophilic pneumonitis, and there's also been studies showing decreased efficacy with the creatinine clearance less than 50. This is a low number of patients, but it's out there. It can cause a neuropathy. It's a once-a-day drug. It covers most of your gram-positive organisms. Very, very expensive. It's probably one of the best strategically priced drugs out there because it's a weight-based dosing and it's priced per vial. And so the average American is probably going to get two vials. Each vial is $250. It cannot be used for pneumonia. Do not give with a statin. It's probably better than vancomycin. And if vancomycin, if the newer agents for Staph aureus were cheaper, we'd probably be using a lot more of these, but they're not. They're priced a lot more, and vancomycin is pretty cheap. Cenerced is an old drug. It's been out there for a long time. Works by inhibiting protein synthesis. Doesn't work all that well, and it causes significant side effects, typically arthralgias. And every patient I've ever had on Cenerced, if they're able to, if they're awake and talking, will tell me to stop the drug. They want to die. They don't care because their joints hurt so bad. Colistin, an old drug. Again, it's being used for multidrug-resistant gram-negatives because we don't really have anything else. It's essentially a detergent. And as newer antibiotics became available, it dropped off the radar. Its main side effect is renal failure. Never give it with an aminoglycoside unless you're just really in dire straits. We do use it a lot in the ICU setting because it's inhalational, or I'll give it IV as a last resort. It's salvage therapy only. Fidaxomicin is the other drug you may use as an outpatient. Approved in 2011. It's used for C. diff. It's a macrocyclic antibiotic. It inhibits RNA polymerase. Fairly well tolerated. Patients have nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, but they have C. diff, you never know. 200 milligrams BID for 10 days. You don't need to renally adjust it. Not studied in kids. It's expensive compared to your other agents, metronidazole, or especially compounded oral vancomycin, which is what we tend to use here. It's difficult to know how to integrate this into your treatment algorithm. It's really been studied as primary therapy, and its claim to fame is it has slightly less incidence of recurrence than using oral vancomycin. People tend to use this as salvage therapy, however, and the studies looking at it that way find that it's no better than any of the other treatments that are already out there. Again, if it costs less, we would use this more, but it doesn't. The antibiotic approved in 2012, just so you've heard this, is beta-quinolone. It's a drug we use for multidrug-resistant TB. Just be aware that this drug is out there. I don't think you would be prescribing this. It's probably going to be your health department or TB experts. There have been other studies recently looking at metronidazole for TB, linezolid for TB. So there's a lot of work trying to get more options out there for our MDR and XDR TB cases, which, as you know, are increasing in number and extremely hard to treat. All right, thank you very much. Your whirlwind tour with antibiotics that we don't want you to prescribe because they're all expensive.
Is there any work being done with like bacteriophages or, you know, for superficial infections, or in addition to some of these expensive antibiotics?
There is work being done with bacteriophages for this. I don't know if they're being looked at for superficial infections. A lot of the effort right now is dedicated towards the multidrug-resistant gram-negatives because patients die from this, and there's really not a lot of treatment options out there. We start to come up with these voodoo recommendations of synergy drugs, so if something that's resistant, we'll go ahead and give them the drug in combination with other things and the hope that this helps. There are a few experimental aminoglycoside derivatives out there for gram-negatives, but really there's not a lot else out there. Here in Utah, I'm happy to say that we don't really treat a lot of these. This hasn't been a big issue. In Seattle and Houston, it was a big issue, and I've had patients die from these organisms when there really wasn't anything else to treat them. The vancomycin?
Yes. And then you talked about using MIC to 4 and 8, whereas MIC was less than 16. Well, I'm not understanding.
So if the MIC is greater than 2, so the key here is if it's greater than 2, it will be marked as intermediate or resistant on the susceptibility panel. You should not use vancomycin. You need an alternative agent. If the MIC is 2, then it's debatable. And most ID doctors would recommend at this point switching to other agents because we have better drugs out there. And that's actually what I recommend as well. It kind of depends. If they're doing well on vancomycin, the MIC is 2, I'll let them ride. If I'm worried they're not doing well, I'll change it. I did not. People used to use it for that. I would not use it. So again, MIC greater than 2, the correct answer is no vancomycin ever. MIC of 2, it's debatable. Most ID doctors would recommend against vancomycin in that scenario. The nice or bad thing about Intermountain is that our lab does not report vancomycin MICs. You have to call them and ask. And so by the time I'm consulted, I can call and usually things have had a chance to stabilize. If they're doing well, I'll let them continue it. If they're not, then I'll just go ahead and change it.
Question? Over here. Hello?
I hear a voice.
Right here.
There you are. Yes.
Yeah, question on recurrent MRSA folliculitis in a patient that really doesn't have a lot of symptoms. It's just this horrible folliculitis.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've done the IV vanco, and we stop, and it comes right back again, and it's like their fourth time, and now they're just saying, I don't want to do anything. So what are your suggestions for that?
So this is borders on voodoo as well, but it's a common problem. This is, it's probably 5% of my practice, and a lot of it's being handled as an outpatient anyway. The issue with these people tends not to be antimicrobial resistance. So it's not so much that they're failing oral trimsulfa or doxycycline or whatever you gave them. It tends to be that it just comes back. And there's a couple of theories to this. One is that patients that are prone to get recurrent staph infections tend to remain colonized with Staph aureus longer than your average person. The other one that I kind of like, although this really is voodoo, is that you end up with kind of a perfect storm of a bug and a host. And I think that for a particular strain of Staph aureus with a particular immune phenotype, and I don't know what that means, they are more likely to get recurrent infections. What I advise to them is treat the current episode of folliculitis or carbuncles or whatever they have, get that calmed down, get all of their open wounds closed, and then embark on a decolonization regimen, my personal version of this is extrapolated from the CT surgery literature. They've had great success at reducing their mediastinitis rates, their sternal osteo rates, because of this. And it essentially involves mupirocin to the nose, as well as chlorhexidine or bleach baths. I do it for a week initially, and then for once a week thereafter to finish out a month's course. And that's made up, by the way. Other doctors have their own versions of this. And that typically will work. The danger with this is that staph colonization is not just confined to the one person. Staph lives in their family members. Staph lives in their dogs. They're pig farmers. It was classically described in pigs back in the day. And it's very hard to really eliminate that strain of staph from their environment. And it's certainly impossible to eliminate staph from any of us. It's a normal flora. And I think that that's not the goal. But the hope is that they'll pick up a different strain that isn't as bad for them, or at least you eliminate that carriage for a period of time. I usually tell them it works in about half the cases. And the ones that don't, you end up chronic suppressive therapy, low doses of Bactrim or doxycycline with the mupirocin. And I went to a talk not too long ago where one of the UCSF ID doctors had a regimen that was like 9 months of this, and he said, no one's ever come back to me, because, so it must work all the time. And I don't know that that's true, but that was his version of this.
Okay, but they're not in danger of going to work and being around other people. They're not going to spread it to somebody who potentially could have a more serious reaction to the...
Well, I mean, the way... You know, I get asked this a lot, too, by patients as well as providers. And the way I think about it, staff is normal. So if you were to survey, we're higher in incidence because we're healthcare providers, but if you were to take 100 people on the street, we typically say around 40% of them will carry Staph aureus, and it's probably around 20 to 25% here in Ogden that carry MRSA. Those rates are higher in bigger cities. So in Houston, it was probably a little over 50% of people that had Staph aureus had MRSA. So is staph contagious? Strictly speaking, yes. If I do not have staph on my body and I come in contact with someone who does, I am likely to pick up carriage with it. And so I've contracted it. But because it's normal flora on our skin, it's not really a problem. And the vast majority of people that are colonized with staph aureus, when you screen them, have never had any issues. And that's kind of why I come back to, I like the idea that there's a particular bug with a host that's causing trouble.
Do probiotics have any role in decreasing the frequency of these infections?
Staph aureus?
Of all infections. I mean, I know there was a study. Okay.
That's the short answer. So Staph aureus for C. diff has been, is common, or Staph aureus, what am I saying? Probiotics for C. diff is used commonly. The data is wishy-washy at best. I usually tell people that it's not going to hurt them. It may not help them. So if it doesn't break the bank, it's okay. But for staph skin infections, I don't think there's any role. I think my time is up.
One last comment real quick. So on Staph aureus or MRSA, the other thing is that not all MRSA is the same. You have different PVL chains, right? You've got PVL5, PVL4, USA300. And
you do.
Some of these are much more virulent and potentially life-threatening than some of the other USA300 types that we have just kind of running around the community.
Correct. And one of the, you know, PVL gets a lot of press, and I, in my mind, this is still a debatable point. So when I was in Seattle, there are ID doctors in Boise that do a lot of research on PVL, and they'll actually recommend throwing in clindamycin to your cellulitis regimen with the thought of inhibiting toxin production from PVL. We didn't really do it in Seattle. I simplify this to usually tell people that there are good strains of Staph aureus and bad strains of Staph aureus, and that includes MSSA as well as MRSA. So MRSA per se does not freak me out. Neither does MSSA, but both of them scare me because both of them can do bad things. Treatment doesn't vary. So the other thing about the PVL and the various strains of community-acquired MRSA is that treatment-wise, it's essentially the same.